Hello, this is Dr. Dawn, the suicide prevention pharmacist, and I am here with podcast number 2 of the suicide prevention podcast. And today I wanted to talk about my story and what has led me to this podcast and led me to my work in suicide prevention. This is unscripted, off the cuff. This is just what's coming to me right here and right now. So it might jump around, it may have some stops and starts, but it will give you some background as to my story and why I want to continue working with suicide prevention. I will start out and I will plan to have this at the end as well. If you or someone you know is experiencing a crisis situation or having any thoughts of suicide or suspect, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available in the United States of America. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That number is 800-273-8255. Again, in the United States, 24/7, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 800-273-8255. There's also the crisis text line. You can text the word HOME, that's H-O-M-E, to 741-741. Again, the crisis text line. You can text the word HOME, which is H-O-M-E, to 741-741. So my story related to suicide and suicide prevention starts over 20 years ago, really. And as I've learned more throughout the years, the family history probably goes on even beyond that. But I will briefly mention that I have lost multiple members of my family to suicide, and I will briefly mention a couple of them here. My cousin Craig and his son Aaron both died by suicide. Craig died in March of 2011, and Aaron died in March of 2014. These were family members that I was close to. We were all born and raised in the same small town in rural Iowa, and so I knew both of them very well. And obviously, to lose a father and a son in a 3-year time span was a very big blow to our family. So I did want to mention them. They have been a part of my story and my family's story, and obviously it had a huge impact on us. So I wanted to mention them. In terms of the details of their stories, though, I feel like a lot of that is not my story to tell. Craig and Aaron's other immediate family members, Kathy and Angela, would have more of that story, and I feel that that's more of their story to share if they so wish. But I did want to mention them and their passing as well. But my big focus will be on my dad. And my dad was first diagnosed with depression in the year 2000. And it was a few months before I was getting ready to graduate from high school. And that was really tough. So I was 18. I'll probably throw some cliches in here, but at 18, I definitely was the stereotypical. I was going to go out and make my mark in the world. There was nothing that was going to hold me back, and I thought I knew how the world worked. I thought I knew everything. So when my dad had this depression, it was right around me graduating from high school. I really thought it was because he didn't want me to leave. He didn't want me to go to college, and I thought he was really pretending, to be honest. And it was very selfish of me now, and you know, thinking it was all about me. But again, a lot of 18-year-olds have that. So that's what happened, and that's how I felt about it. So I kind of thought it was a big production over nothing. However, that summer before I left for college, he was hospitalized for his depression. And not only was he hospitalized, but he also underwent the electric, they're commonly known as electric shock or electroconvulsive therapy treatments. He did undergo those and did experience some amnesia with those, but those were pretty scary because we didn't really understand a lot of what that is. Again, as an 18-year-old, I'm hearing shock therapy, and that doesn't sound very pleasant. And him being in the hospital, I believe he was in the hospital about a month. That was a lot. That was a lot happening. He was able to come home before I left for college, but probably one of the hardest things in my life was that day that I left for college. And he just cried and cried and cried, and I cried, and I have a brother, Dylan, he cried, my mom cried. It was very traumatic, and it was very hard, and I had really thought long and hard if I should stay and help take care of him, but I knew I had to move on with life, and I had a career I wanted to prepare for, and I knew I wanted to be a pharmacist, and I was planning to do pre-pharmacy coursework and then go into pharmacy school, and so I knew I had to go, but it was incredibly, incredibly hard. The good news with that episode is that around, I want to say it was maybe late September, sometime in October, he started feeling better. The right type of therapy and medication treatment kind of found the right combination, and he felt better. And so after, I would say 6 to 8 months, if I can remember correctly, he went back to work. And then life went on. He stopped his medications for depression after about a year or so, which I believe at the time was pretty much standard of practice. And he went back to work. We all went on with our lives. I went to college. As I said, I did my pre-pharmacy work, got into pharmacy school, graduated from pharmacy school. My brother, who's a few years younger than me, also finished high school, went to college as well, finished college, and we both started our own adult lives, and life kind of went on. But around, I want to say it was early 2011, Dad had some issues with his bladder, and he was needing surgery for his bladder. And so this is very scary. Initially, it was thought that maybe he had some kind of bladder cancer. Luckily, that was found to not be the case. So we went ahead and went on to another diagnosis that involved his having a surgery need. So he had the surgery. I believe this was early January of 2011, and the surgery went fine, but he was going to have about 6 weeks of recovery. Well, during that time, he did go into another depression. So there are some theories about what might have precipitated the events. As we know, depression is not an easy thing to diagnose. There's a lot of different factors. There's a lot of research, a lot of different things that are happening in the world and being researched in terms of what causes depression. There's thoughts about genetics, there's thoughts about diet, the environmental things that we're exposed to, there's perhaps toxins, that kind of thing. So one of the potential theories that we had is maybe there was something about the anesthesia and his surgery. And actually going back to the first time he was depressed, there had been an incident where he was using Roundup, which is a weed killer, and he had gotten some on his skin and had kind of an exposure to that. Nothing serious that we thought at the time, but definitely looking back in hindsight, maybe we felt that maybe that was some kind of exposure that kind of wasn't the whole cause, but maybe was a triggering event. But I digress, like I mentioned that I might. But going back to 2011, he'd had this surgery, was recovering, and had this depression. Somewhat similar course as the first time around, although at this point, there really weren't any hospital beds available, so he wasn't hospitalized at this point. He was managed on an outpatient basis and he had therapy again. He was put on medications again, and so he was home. I want to say again, it was another 6 or 7 months, kind of got the right combination of medications again. I think it was a little bit different this time, but found out and he got better. The hard part about this time though is that he didn't have a job to go back to because he had been gone long enough and they weren't able to keep it open for him. So that was really hard, and it seemed like that time around was a little different because it happened again. I think the first time around he got better, and it was almost an instantaneous getting better the first time around. It's like he woke up one day and he was fine. He went back to driving, which he hadn't done, going outside, which he hadn't done a lot. So the first time around was pretty immediate and pretty dramatic. The second time around also was pretty immediate and pretty dramatic, but it was the second time, and he was going to end up staying on medication more long term. And again, that was standard practice. I believe that still is. And so he was going to stay on the medications, but not having the job, not necessarily having a lot to do was hard. And so, he's trying to work on finding a new job, and that was hard, and just kind of navigating this world. And so 2011 kind of finished out with that, but then we move forward to 2012, and I want to say it was around May, he started feeling symptoms of his depression again, and he had kind of told my mom, and I know it was towards the beginning of May because then they had come up for a visit. When I say come up, I was no longer living in rural Iowa where I was born and raised. I was living in a bigger town in Iowa, and they were visiting, and so he was sliding back into this depression. Well, this was really tough for everybody because it was so soon. It hadn't even been a year since he had came out of his last bout of depression. So this was hard for everybody. And it was really taking a toll, obviously, on my dad and on my mom, who was trying to work and pay the bills and take care of him too. And then it was hard on my brother and I as well because we weren't there to help. We were calling, we were visiting when we could, but we weren't there in a more all-encompassing way. So that was hard. I can only imagine now. I didn't necessarily know it at the time, but boy, we were scared. There was a lot of fear. And so now that I think about it, and what's really hard to think about is how much fear and what was going on in his mind, or what wasn't going on in his mind, because he laid in bed all day and the time just moved so slowly. So to me, it feels like every minute must have been excruciating. Every 5 minutes, and let alone an hours of the day when he was home alone, and then my mom would come home from working, goodness knows, 10, 12-hour days, and have that little time. But even that, when he did have people around, everything was too much. Like, the noise was too much, the conversations, anything was just, it was overwhelming to him. And he shared that with me at one point, that all of the noise and the talking, like, he wanted people around, but he couldn't keep up with conversations, and so it was a struggle. So it was like he was in a prison, and I still struggle with that even today, to think of how terrible that must have felt. He also talked about at different points that he did have voices. He did have voices in his head. So while his formal diagnosis was depression, it sounds like he might have had some schizophrenic, you know, with auditory hallucinations. I mean, I'm not here to diagnose him, but definitely some more going on in the depression and in our minds, and based on what he was telling us. So to have those voices and he even said there were voices that told him he should die, that he shouldn't be here, that it's not, you know, he's not worth it. And I struggle with that today. I feel really sad for the suffering that he endured. And I know he's not the only one out there, the only one that's been through that or experienced that, but knowing him as my dad, that's very hard. So he was in bed, he was struggling, you know, the doctors were working on getting the right combination of meds and treatment. Again, there weren't really any beds or anything for him from a behavioral health standpoint. But then in early July of 2012, he ended up having a small stroke. And it was, luckily, they did all the radiology, all the testing. It was very small. It might have been more of a, not even what they call a stroke, but like a smaller occlusion or blockage or whatever. And so that was good news. But his symptoms were fairly pronounced. He was brought to the bigger town in Iowa where my husband and I lived, or my now husband. He wasn't my husband at the time. But we went to visit him, and his speech, you couldn't quite understand what he said. His words were mixed up and jumbled, and it was really scary to see him and interact with him. Now, the good news is those symptoms resolved in a few days, but then the depression just came right back in. And so I felt like I was pleading and begging the medical staff to get some help for the behavioral health, because they weren't concerned about the stroke and that was all good and everything, which was good news. But for me, it was like, well, he's still depressed. What can we do? So we worked on getting him to an outpatient program where he'd go somewhere during the day. He stayed with my now husband and me. And I would take him, and it was, I can't remember, it was 9 to 3 every day, but they had classes, and he did different things, and then at night he'd come home, and he would pretty much just go to bed, again, because he had mentioned, like, the talking, and the interaction was really overwhelming for him, so that's what we did, and I want to say we did that for about a week. But then one day, he said, you know, I don't want to go to that program anymore. It's not helping me. I am not going to do this anymore. So he said, I'm not going to eat. I'm not going to do anything, because I just want to go home. I just want to go home, and my parents are still living in small town Iowa, and he's like, I want to go home. So I was very scared at that point, because he was threatening not to eat, and basically he was at a point where he had put his foot down, and being an adult, that was his decision and his choice. It was really hard throughout all of this too, because I am his daughter, and talk about a role reversal. I felt like I was the parent and he was the child. But still being an adult, he was able to convey his wishes. And I wanted to give him some autonomy, even though I didn't agree with him. So he said he wanted to go home. So I called my mom, and she picked him up later that evening or the next day. I don't remember exactly when. And very sadly, That was the last time I saw my dad. Because about a, I think it was another week or so later, on July 27th of 2012, my mom and one of her coworkers went home to check on him because he wasn't doing the calls that my mom had asked him to do every day to check in. He hadn't done his morning call. They went to check on them, check on him, and they found him in her basement, and he had died by suicide. So, for those of you who know me and know my family and know my dad, you would know that he's a big hunter. He was a big hunter, and he did fish as well, but he loved to hunt turkey and deer, and he had shotguns and bow and arrows, and just he loved hunting and being outdoors. And so even though we had tried to do as much means restriction as we could with the firearms, and we had everything locked up, everything was where we thought he couldn't get something. He had found a way. He had basically kicked or punched or somehow opened a door that was completely locked, was able to force through it, and found a firearm to use. And so that was really hard because we had done everything we could to make sure he didn't have access. But unfortunately, whatever was going on in his mind that day, whatever was happening, he found a way. And it's I can only imagine what it was like for my mom and her coworker to find that. I still I don't know why I do it, but I still think about those minutes before my dad died and what he was thinking and what, or if he was thinking. I mean, I don't even know, but I just, that extreme suffering that had to have been happening, that was the course of action that he took. And so that's just really, that's really hard. Process, and it's been almost 10 years, and I still struggle with a lot of pieces of this. I think about those moments before. I think about the moments potentially after. We'll never, and you can say it was the depression and whatever the voices in his head, and that was probably part of it too. As a pharmacist, we had learned about people who take medications like antidepressants. They potentially will they'll take a medication, they're so depressed they won't do anything, including if they have suicidal thoughts, they won't act on them because they're so depressed they won't act on them. The theory is that if you take a medication and you start to feel a little better, well, maybe you still have all those terrible thoughts or ideas, but now you have just a little bit more oomph, a little bit more ability to carry through on those. So a lot of those medications have warnings about that. Now, there's a lot of debate about that. So, to each their own, I guess, after you look at the evidence. To me, I feel like that was a contributing factor. He had his medications changed up again, and just a few days before he died, he had gotten in the car and drove. He was feeling really good. He had a really good day, and I talked to him on the phone, but then within 24 hours, he was already feeling like he was like going back into these depressive symptoms. So it was very discouraging for him. The last time I talked to him, which was the night before he died, I remember distinctly, and I'm pretty sure I told my mom this too, because I usually talk to both my parents when I called. I remember distinctly he seemed very angry, just just not happy. He didn't like my questions. He didn't seem like he wanted to converse. And I told my mom that, but I actually felt in a way it was positive because he was having some emotion. He was feeling something. It wasn't this dull, flat affect. So I felt that that was potentially a good sign. But again, that ties back into that, well, okay, maybe he was starting to get some ability to carry through on some of the things that he was feeling. All of this is just conjecture. All of this is theory. None of this is proven. We'll never know exactly why, or are all the details. He was alone. He actually died in my childhood bedroom as I was getting older, and my brother and I each had a separate room. So they had made a room in the basement for me. So it was the room where it was my bedroom. So that was weird. The other thing is that July 27th, 2012 was also my mom's birthday. It was her 58th birthday. And so every year since then, we have her birthday, but it's also the anniversary of when my dad died. So, and I could go off onto so many other tangents, so many different things, so many different experiences that I had, my family had, the feelings that we felt, the things we went through. And I know a lot of people will have similar experiences, but yet unique in their own way. And I just, it's just hard, and it continues to be that way, that it's still, whether you know, we like it or not, and we certainly didn't choose it this way, but it's been a defining moment in my life. But that being said, life does go on, and I don't want my dad's death to be in vain, and Craig and Aaron's either, but especially for my dad, since I knew him the best. It didn't take too long, maybe a year or so, I started getting into NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I started teaching family-to-family classes, and started getting involved in that work. There were some walks I did as well. I started getting more involved in NAMI, and so I joined the board of directors for the state of Iowa. I was also president of that board for a couple years. I was trained in the NAMI provider course. So family to family talks about mental illness and ways to cope and different strategies, and works with families, as the name implies. NAMI provider helps work with healthcare providers to help them understand the experience of people with mental illness and what their families, loved ones, friends are going through. So I helped do some teaching. I was on the board of directors for the state of Iowa. So I got involved in that. That included some, not only education, but advocacy and support work as well. My family then moved, so I do have my husband, and I have a 5-year-old son, and my mom also, although she doesn't live with us, we all moved to Arizona in mid 2020, and since then I have been trying to work on the suicide prevention aspect. And so I just try to research and put information on my website and talk about it. And I haven't gotten so much into NAMI here in Arizona, but I am trying to get more involved in the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. I am planning to do an overnight walk in New York City in June. And this has been an event that's been going on for a long time, but it sounds like a wonderful way to raise money for suicide prevention work and network with people who've had similar experiences. There's also a suicide loss survivor, long-term suicide loss survivor conference that's coming up in the summer as well that I'm planning to attend. But I wanted to take what my family had been through and my experience and see if there's a way that we can help others and spread information and help others and hopefully get people to a place where they can find resources and find help and know they're not alone. And so I wanted to take what happened to my family and take that grief, take that loss, take that anger, take all of that emotion and try to do something positive about it. So that's where my work is leading me to now. So if you've hung in this long, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening to my story. I feel like I just scratched the surface, but it gives you the basics of why I'm here and what I'm doing. And I appreciate you listening. If you have any comments or anything you want to share, you can share it on my Facebook page or my LinkedIn page or on my website. And again, I just appreciate you listening, and I hope you can take something from it and share the message of suicide prevention with others. As I close, I just want to give the National Suicide Prevention Line. This is here in the United States of America. I want to give that number again. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The number is 800-273-8255. And there's also the crisis text line available. You can text the word HOME, that's H-O-M-E, to 741-741. Again, thank you so much for listening. This has been Dr. Dawn, the Suicide Prevention Pharmacist, and this has been the Suicide Prevention Podcast. Take care.